Good afternoon, everyone. On behalf of the Clerk of the Senate, Dr. Rosemary Lang, welcome to the Senate Occasional Lecture for August. My name is Bronwyn Notson, and I'm very pleased to introduce our lecturer today, Ms. Margaret Fitzherbert. Margaret is the Senior Manager of Communications and Government at the Civic Group in Melbourne. This is following several senior communication management roles for major companies, including ANZ and the National Australia Bank. She was previously an industrial advocate in the public health sector and an advisor to two Howard government ministers. Margaret has contributed chapters to several books and essay collections, and her first book, Liberal Women, Federation to 1949, was published in 2004 and shortlisted in that year's New South Wales Premier's History Awards. Her second book, So Many Firsts, Liberal Women from Enid Lyons to the Turnbull Era, was published in 2009. Margaret has a Bachelor of Arts with Honours, a Graduate Diploma in Labour Relations Law, and a Master of Arts in Communications. She is currently a Director of Melbourne's Royal Women's Hospital Trustees and a Trustee of the Queen Victoria Women's Trust, and was awarded a Federation Medal in 2001. Please join me in welcoming Margaret.
Thank you very much for that warm welcome, and thank you for inviting me to be part of this lecture series. I hope you will forgive me for having what some people might consider a slightly blunt topic for my lecture: Liberal Women in Parliament, What Do the Numbers Tell Us, and Where To From Here? And I hope you'll also forgive me for being somewhat snuffly. I have brought a cold with me from Melbourne, and so if I need to cough and splutter, I apologise in advance. Numbers are the atom of politics. Nothing is possible without them. It isn't possible for anyone to be pre-selected to a seat or win an election or get a leadership role in a party or successfully move their policy into reality without numbers. I'm going to start my lecture with a very short history lesson, mainly for the purpose of comparison, and this too is largely about numbers. As I think many people here would know, if not all, Australian women have had the vote longer than almost every other country in the world and were the first to get the right to be elected to the federal parliament. But it took decades to see the first women elected to the federal parliament in 1943. And it's no coincidence that one was the widow of a former prime minister, and they were both elected during World War II, which was when Australia was having what I see as one of its sort of periodic reconsiderations of the role of women in society. The first two women elected, of course, represented both the major parties as they were then, Dorothy Tangney from the ALP and Enid Lyons from the United Australia Party, which later became the Liberal Party. The two major parties have taken vastly different approaches to how to get its women into Parliament, and for that matter, how, if at all, they make an attempt to appeal to women voters. Today, the ALP has significantly more women in Parliament than does the Liberal Party, and I think it's timely to reflect on why that is and also what next for the Liberals. But this is a bit of a change because for many decades, the non-Labor parties definitely had the numbers in terms of women in Parliament. In the early part of the 20th century, the women who most actively supported non-Labor parties by joining a party-like organisation were the largest organisation of politically active women in the country, and I'm speaking of the Australian Women's National League. And they were also the country's largest women's voluntary organisation for much of the period that they existed. They had a vast number of members. It declined significantly by the time it merged with the Liberal Party in the 1940s, but at its peak, around the time of World War I, they had around 40,000 members, which is massive for any voluntary organisation, but especially so considering the population of the time. Now, in time, this group of women and what they represented translated into a number of significant firsts in Australian political history. And non-Labor women became the first women elected to parliaments in almost every state and in the House of Representatives. The first Australian woman to be a minister in any parliament was Florence Cardell Oliver in Western Australia in 1947, and she was a Liberal. And that same year, Annabel Rankin became opposition whip in the Senate and was the first woman to hold that role. She too was a Liberal. I should add that although the Liberals had exactly three senators at that time. That was the entire opposition. It probably wasn't that hard to get yourself elected whip. Nonetheless, she maintained that role for many, many years and later became a minister. The first female member of the federal cabinet was a Liberal in Dame Enid Lyons. She occupied this role because she was appointed vice president of the Executive Council. She attended cabinet meetings, but she did not have a portfolio. Her brother-in-law told her that having the role was a toothless tiger and she should have declined it. She said she agreed it was a toothless tiger, but she was prepared to take what she could get, basically. The first woman to be a federal minister with a portfolio was Dame Annabel Rankin, who was a Liberal, and the first woman to be a cabinet minister with portfolio was, of course, Dame Margaret Guilfoyle. While this was happening, the UAP and then the Liberal Party had a distinct advantage in terms of the women's vote. They got more votes from women than did the Labor Party over a score of federal elections. And in close elections, and some of them were over this period, that really mattered. So one reason why the Liberals did so well in harvesting, for want of a better term, the women's vote is that they pioneered campaigning directly to women. In the early days of the 20th century, they did this largely through direct canvassing, which is how most election campaigns were conducted. And the way the Liberals and their predecessors did it was by women to women. They naturally involved senior politicians of the day, most of whom were men, but it was the women who were running the campaigns and providing the workforce of people who were literally knocking on doors and so on. A number of non-Labor women's organisations did this, and the best known is probably the Australian Women's National League. It was known as the AWNL, and it was a Victorian organisation, although it later set up shop as well in Tasmania. It held political meetings for women, and in the days before television, these were routinely attended by hundreds of people. And they were also literally a door-knocking machine that I think the major parties today would envy. And this was the way they took their message directly to women in their homes. Some of these women were volunteers, some of them were paid by the parties, and they produced material that was addressed directly to women as well. The central organisations of the non-Labor parties were certainly influenced by these women who were voluntary campaigners and also paid organisers. And it meant that from the very early years of the 20th century, the non-Labor parties produced election material that was directed specifically at women. And they were the only ones to do this, in large part. When the Liberal Party was formed, it continued this tradition, and in fact, it went further by having a status of women section in its party platform as early as the late 1940s. And if you look at these, if you're feeling, you know, in need of a way to address a lack of sleep one night, if you look at these, you'll find that they mirror the platforms that the women's organisations in the various states had prior to the Liberal Party being formed. And they talked about things like equality of opportunity, divorce law reform, which was a big one because men and women were treated differently by the courts in relation to divorce. And another issue that they were particularly big on was custody of children after a divorce or separation. So these, in turn, were taken into the Liberal Party's platform. And they were turned into specific policies for women in the elections of 1946 and 1949. The history of organisations like the AWNL fed into the new Liberal Party in the 1940s, and what happened was that hundreds of women who'd gained real political experience in campaigns, running campaigns, pre-selecting candidates, in some instances actually being the candidates, they took these skills to the Liberal Party. And as well as the AWNL, there was also the Women's Liberal League from New South Wales, the AWNL from Tasmania, and the Queensland Women's Electoral League from that state. And the big reason why organisations like these were prepared to give up their independence, which is something they had jealously guarded for many decades, they had knocked back offers and threats to merge into the central party organisation previously, going back as far as the days of Deakin. The reason why they chose to give up that independence quite consciously was because they wanted to see women elected to Parliament, and they thought the best way to do this was to be at the heart of the party and actively influencing it from the centre of its power rather than being a highly influential body that was effectively a satellite rather than part of the party organisation. And just to digress briefly, they weren't alone in that. If you look at the UAP, it was sort of a coalition of a range of organisations that were part of the party structure. It's one reason why it needed to change. It would have been like herding cats, I suspect. The other reason for the Liberal Party's early approach to women as voters and as potential MPs was Robert Menzies. And there are various reasons for this. Menzies was from Victoria, where the AWNL was particularly strong, and he held the seat of Kooyong. He held the seat of Kooyong, where the AWNL was especially strong. This was one of their strongholds, and they had branches of the size of about 1,000 members or so at most times. So by the time the Liberal Party was formed, Menzies has been working side by side with women, running campaigns, and as fairly equal participants since about the 1920s. And Elizabeth Couchman, who headed the AWNL, was one of his allies within the UAP. They were particularly close, and he rated her skills as a politician and later said of her, "She would have been the best cabinet minister I could have wished for." Well before the Second World War was over, Menzies had come to a bit of a change of heart on the role of women in society. And a lot of this came from travelling in Britain in particular and seeing the vastly different roles and experiences that women were having there. And he believed that this would also change what happened with women in Australia, as women showed themselves as capable of work that previously had been thought either unsuitable for them or just beyond their capacity. And he also thought that their aspirations would change as a result of this experience, and that it wouldn't be the same as the previous World War, when women had gone into roles that they hadn't previously done, and then when the war was over and the men came home, the women had gone back to the home largely. He believed that wouldn't happen this time. And he also argued that this was a good thing, that a greater degree of gender equality was actually desirable. He discussed this on a number of occasions in his Forgotten People radio broadcasts in the 1940s. And one of the things he said was, "In the long run, won't our community be a stronger, better balanced and more intelligent community when the last artificial disabilities imposed upon women by centuries of custom have been removed?" In 1943, the Women for Canberra movement started, and this was a local copy of the Women for Westminster campaign in London, which was aimed at getting more women into Parliament in Britain. And this was big news at the time. Menzies was asked to respond, and he actually spent one of his radio broadcasts talking about this topic in particular. He said, this is a brief quote, I'm not going to read you the entire speech, "Of course women are at least the equals of men. Of course there is not reason why a qualified woman should not sit in the Parliament or on the bench or in a professorial chair or preach from the pulpit or, if you like, command an army in the field. No educated man today denies a place or a career to a woman because she is a woman." I guess I'd have to say to that, there were obviously a lot of uneducated men around. Menzies' Forgotten People speeches have been very, very well analysed, and I don't propose to revisit all of that here, except to say that one thing he did particularly well was to appeal to women in ways that were very direct, addressing them directly, talking about issues that were about women, as well as in ways that were quite subtle. And in doing this, he was light years away from the ALP and its approach to women at the time. Prime Minister John Curtin and the ALP continued to see women's political concerns as effectively a derivation of those held by men, and they seemed to anticipate a return to more usual working conditions when the war was over. To be fair, that's probably not an unreasonable view and one that would have been held by many people at the time. So in the elections of 1946 and 1949, we see the Liberals address material to men and women, separately and together. They develop a women's policy statement, and they have the extension of child endowment to firstborn children as a key policy to women. And some of the ads were directed only to women. For example, it's interesting to me that the industrial relations policy was spelled out to women quite specifically and directly. It's not a link you would necessarily think is natural or to be expected. The ads made the link that strikes and food shortages affect women the most because they're the ones who are trying to run a household and they're the ones who have to literally go and stand in the queues and wait for the food and see what they can get that day. And that's spelled out quite directly. That was spelled out quite directly in those terms. The ALP did it quite differently. This was one of the instances where they did actually address an ad to women, which from memory was done in the Women's Weekly. And they focused on job security, and they spoke about it in terms of you're probably very worried about your husband's job. But the real killer in this, I think, was the very start of Curtin's message, which probably seemed like a winner at the time, but I don't know. It started off, "To the housewives of Australia, you are probably too busy to be bothered with politics." So a dismissive start before you get into it, quite different to making the point that you understand these women have to go and stand in queues to get basic food items to feed their family. So the Liberals' tactics sound pretty obvious today, but in the 1940s they were new and radical, and they were pretty much setting the standard in how to do this stuff. History records that the Liberals won the federal election in 1949, and in the years that followed, they maintained their lead in the women's vote, and they sent an increasing number of women into the parliament. And this happened around the country, but it was most pronounced, I think, federally. Following the election of the ALP's Dorothy Tangney to the Senate in 1943, the next six female senators were Liberals until the election of Labor's Ruth Coleman in 1974. But after this, things started to change. And today, if you compare the number of ALP women to the number of Liberal women who've been elected to the federal parliament between 1943 and 2011, this is what the record tells us. The ALP has elected 32 women to the Senate over that period, and the Liberals have elected 24. In the House of Representatives, 53 ALP women have been elected, compared to 29 Liberals. So if my maths is right, that gives totals of 85 ALP women to 53 Liberal women. I'm sure if I'm wrong, someone's going to put their hand up and tell me. No? Good. I'll accept that's right. Today, if you look at the figures today, rather than the historical trend, there are 12 ALP women senators and 6 Liberal women in the Senate. And in the House of Representatives, there are 22 ALP women and 15 Liberal women. And it's also interesting to note, if you look a little bit more deeply at these figures, that the ALP has been better at renewing in the House of Representatives. On my count, every single one of its women was elected after the quota was introduced in 1994. And of the Liberals' 15 women, 2 were in the Parliament before that time. In general terms, the state parliaments show a very similar trend, and exciting as it would be, I won't go through every state, but let me highlight 3 states where there have been fairly recent changes in government, and for that reason, I think they give us a pretty powerful snapshot of what is happening now. In Victoria, which of course had an election in 2010, there are 19 ALP women, including Jennifer Kanas, who was elected at a by-election last month, and 9 Liberal women. And of these Liberal women, 5 were elected at the last election, and it would not be unfair to say that most of them were pre-selected when their seats were considered unwinnable. And that is, they had, in one instance, the best margin in one of those seats was 3.2%. The trend was showing no swing, really, effectively, to the opposition. So it was considered a near thing that the seat of Mordialloc, for example, would be won with that margin. But indeed, the election-clinching seat of Bentley was also won with a margin of around 6%. It was totally unexpected. Bentley is Victoria's version of the federal seat of Bass. If you can win Bentley, you can win government. It's a very marginal seat, and before going into that election, most people were not counting it as a given. In the Victorian upper house, the numbers are even, with each major party contributing 6 women, and the Liberals elected 1 new woman to the Legislative Council at that last election. In New South Wales, the Legislative Council has 7 ALP women and 4 Liberal women, and in the Legislative Assembly, there are 9 Liberals and 9 from the ALP. And now let me take you to Queensland, which of course has only one chamber, the Legislative Assembly, and earlier this year had an election of what I would consider tsunami-like proportions. Today, the ALP opposition has been reduced to 7 members, of which 3 are women, and one of these was elected in 2012, which, from the perspective of getting women into Parliament, I think that's quite a spectacular result, really, in the circumstances for that party. On the other side of the chamber, the Liberals have a team of 78, and there are additionally 2 CATA party members and 4 independents. So the Liberals have an increase in 44 members at the last election and 78 MPs, but only 13 women are among this team. So the obvious question to ask is, if the pre-selection process is based on merit, then why are women coming through that process in such small numbers? Were they just not good enough? Or was something else at play? Aside from the raw numbers, it's worth considering this. In each state, the Liberals have picked up new seats, and what they hold is very likely a high watermark. Might not be, but I think particularly in Queensland, you'd have to say, they're not likely to go much further than that. It should be a golden opportunity to see a greater number of women elected as part of a pool of members that is also increased. In other words, there are more seats to go around. I see no reason why there shouldn't be more seats for women as part of that. But instead, the number of women candidates was generally low. Campbell Newman, in particular, was criticised for the number of Liberal National Party women candidates running in Queensland, an election where his party was generally seen as pretty much unbeatable. During the campaign, Newman was asked about this and he acknowledged it and said that the LNP had not done a good job in recruiting female political candidates when only 16 of the 89 candidates was female. "I wish we had more female candidates," he said. "So long as I'm the leader of the LNP, I will always push for more women to be pre-selected." What happened to cause these figures in Victoria, Queensland and New South Wales? I think you could probably construct a number of lectures around that, so I'll quickly summarise my version of it now. In the 1970s, the rise of second wave feminism prompted a new approach by the ALP and the influx of an increasing number of ALP women into parliaments around the country and here. But the turning point was the federal election of 1983, when the ALP, largely, I think, through Senator Susan Ryan's efforts, used an approach that was really strikingly similar to what the Liberals had done back in 1949. They targeted women through the campaign and including through the leaders' interactions with voters. They offered policies that were specifically geared towards women, and there I'm thinking in particular of equal opportunity legislation. And they also selected a much greater number of women as candidates. And these tactics worked. For the first time in 1983, the ALP had more women in the federal parliament than did the Liberal Party. The federal Liberals lost their lead with women voters for the first time since the 1940s. And since then, the Liberals have elected more women to the federal parliament at only one election, and that was in 1996. And it's worth considering why it is that 1996 was special and different. Prior to that year, women in the Liberal Party, and particularly in New South Wales, began to push for a greater number of female candidates. They were frustrated by the low number that had been pre-selected at elections in the early 1990s, and they demanded that this be fixed. And the central argument was, you've just got to pre-select more women. They set up a range of programs to assist with this. They identified candidates and they set up structures to support more women candidates. But in my view, the most valuable thing they did was elevate the issue and vocally demand that more women run, be taken seriously and pre-selected in winnable seats. And when you look at the history of the Liberal Party and its forerunners, women's representation has been best when exactly this has happened, when the women of the party have loudly demanded more seats and then they've organised to go out and get them. And it's been even better when the party's leadership supported that push as well. When the Liberals did so well in 1996, it was seen by many as a vindication of the Liberals' rejection of quotas, which was, as you will recall if you were there, was a big issue at around the same time. And many crowed that the Liberals had elected the greatest ever number of women to Parliament without having to rely on a quota. The ALP quota was born in 1994 when the ALP introduced a 35% pre-selection quota for women in all winnable seats by 2002. As a result, the percentage of female candidates pre-selected increased from 14.5% in 1994 to 35.6% in 2010. From the 1st of January of this year, the system has been altered again, so that the outcome should be that not less than 40% of ALP seats will be filled by women and not less than 40% by men. There were a range of arguments about the quota, and most of these were based on accusations that this was tokenism and complaints that pre-selection should be about merit. My own view is that the ALP found a way of fixing the problem that was consistent with its own political culture. Gender became another factor that had to be accommodated along with other things that had to be accommodated, like factions. So to me, it's basically adding another layer on that in a way that suits the culture of that party. Nearly 20 years after the quota was agreed, it's clear that it's resulted in a steady pipeline of women into parliaments around the country. And yes, there have been some duds among their number, although I'm not going to name them here, just as there have been among their male colleagues. But there's also been a large number of women who are effective in their ministries and shadow ministries, and there is a much bigger pool to choose from. So why do the Liberals lag on numbers of MPs? Well, in my view, there are a couple of obvious reasons. The first is that, unlike the ALP, there's not been persistent and vocal pressure to keep pre-selecting women. I mentioned earlier that the Liberal Party and its forerunners have been there at their best on this front when the party activists have argued for women and they've identified women candidates and they've supported them. And there's evidence of this happening in a number of states and federally as early as the 1920s. On the state side of things. And in fact, it's the reason why in Queensland, Irene Longman became the first woman MP in that state. She was a nationalist and was elected when, in that state, women didn't have pre-selection rights with their party organisation, the Nationalists. So they decided to hold their own pre-selection. They pre-selected their own candidate. They ran her as a nationalist. They ran her campaign and they won the election. And after that, they had pre-selection rights because they sort of had to. That was quite different to what happened in Victoria and Tasmania and New South Wales, where women were generally part of the pre-selection process at all times. This sort of activity in identifying women, getting them into Parliament, arguing that it was a necessary process, was especially prevalent right after the formation of the party in the 1940s, when the new women's councils in almost every state mandated that there needed to be at least one woman on their Senate ticket. Now, today people look at Senate tickets and say, you know, one woman, that's not really enough. But back then when there were none, you had to start somewhere. And they actually succeeded. They generally managed to pull that off in most states within a few years. And again, as I said earlier, we saw the same sort of thing happening in 1996, activity that leads to results. But after the tide of Liberal women started to go out in the election of 1998, the really strong and vocal demand for women candidates seemed to diminish and lack some momentum. And instead there was a view that merit-based pre-selections would fix the problem, and it was often said that time would take care of this. It would just take time to catch up. And I think, frankly, this was a mistake. Leaving aside the method it's chosen to use in quotas, the ALP has had highly visible individual champions of this issue, and it's also had organisational champions. A range of the ALP's parliamentary leaders have used their influence and clout to support individual candidates, to demand more women candidates, and they have, in some instances, stepped in and supported specific women. And they've helped to keep that issue current. In the context of how parties pre-select candidates, and I admit this is very much one of the dark arts, the leader's imprimatur for an individual or a type of candidate is obviously enormously helpful. The most visible ALP woman who has pushed and pushed for women in Parliament is the former Premier Joan Kerner. Joan is now in her mid-70s and she retired from Parliament 20 years ago. But she remains unstoppable in arguing for Labor women in Parliament and personally has supported many, many women to get there. And I think she deserves a lot of credit for doing that, when I'm sure at this stage of her life there are a lot of other things that she could be doing. The ALP also has Emily's List, which offers financial and political support to pro-choice women candidates and MPs, and it gives mentoring, training and research. And these are no doubt very valuable things, but I think the other thing it does very effectively is that it's a constant niggle, it's a constant reminder within the ALP and also publicly that the ALP has to look for and promote women candidates. And all this, in my view, contrasts with the Liberal Party quite strongly. In recent elections, the Liberals have either got to the end of the pre-selection process and discovered there were too few women, like in Queensland, or they've got halfway through and then worried that there are too few women and then pre-selected them in marginal and probably unwinnable seats at the end, as they did in Victoria. And it's time the Liberal Party did some sensible analysis of the barriers to women in pre-selection. If the issue is that not enough women are nominating for pre-selection, then why is this? It's too easy, I think, to say, as some do, that this is because women don't like the adversarial nature of politics and reject it, because I think the evidence in this place suggests otherwise. And I think it's also wrong to say, as some people do, that it's just too demanding for women with young children or families. And right now, these are assumptions, but I don't know that anyone's ever gone and done some research and assessed whether that's actually true. Maybe at least part of the problem is not actually about the women, but about the process that confronts them. I think it is likely that at least some women look at pre-selection and they don't see a process that's based on merit. They see a process where women are treated differently and are disadvantaged as a result. They see an ordeal ahead where their decisions about their lives and their families will be judged, and in a way that is not done to men. And I understand why some women decide that this is just simply something that they don't want to put themselves through, or that there is no point in doing so. And this brings me to another reason why the Liberal Party finds itself on the back foot with women candidates, and that is party culture. It's a culture which largely tolerates branch members asking women candidates for pre-selection questions about their parental and marital status. More than 40 years ago, Margaret Guilfoyle was asked at her first pre-selection who would look after her three children if she became a senator. And she had a ripper of an answer to that. She said, look, you're here to make a decision about who should be pre-selected for the Senate, and I'm the person who makes decisions about my children, and I accept that you will make a good decision today and you should leave the decision-making about my children to me. I'm not sure if that answer was given today, it would work as well, but good luck to her for pulling it off. Leaving that aside, women today who seek Liberal pre-selection are routinely asked precisely the same question. Those who are unmarried or who have no children find that their circumstances are also questioned by delegates. And these issues have, frankly, no place in a job interview, which is what these conversations are, even if they take place in a branch meeting or in someone's lounge room. In fact, if these questions did occur in a regular job interview, they'd be illegal. It's not a merit-based process if only the women candidates for pre-selection are asked who will look after their children when they go into Parliament. It's not a merit-based process if only the female candidates for pre-selection are asked if they might be considering how they're going to have a whether they're going to have a family and how they think they might juggle this with being in the Parliament. And it's not a merit-based process if only the female candidates are told by delegates that, you know, maybe you should wait till your children are just a little bit older before you have a go at this. And to use another example that I came across a few weeks ago, it's not a merit-based process if a local MP is asked to identify potential candidates and he names a woman and then adds in a sort of rueful tone that she's just got married and he thinks he'll probably have kids soon. So if the Liberal Party is serious about boosting its numbers of women in Parliament, then it needs to tackle this admittedly extremely difficult problem. And the first step, in my view, is to acknowledge it and to loudly condemn it. There have been some move forwards on this front. In 2008, the former Howard government minister David Kemp did a review of the Victorian Liberals organisation, and he identified this problem of women being asked these kind of questions and described it as unacceptable. And one outcome of that review is that the pre-selection form was altered so that it no longer asked candidates to list their children. I have never seen another job application that does that. But anyway, it's gone now. Despite this change, which is a very good thing, and well done to David Kemp for doing it, the questions continue. And, you know, despite the ease with which Margaret Guilfoyle dealt with this question, there is actually no easy answer to these questions. And leaving that aside, there's also the issue of what the questions reveal about the pre-selector's perceptions and what they look for in a candidate. And there's also the distinct possibility that capable women look at what happens to others in this way during pre-selection and they decide to simply not try. The fact that some women manage to overcome this kind of questioning doesn't mean that it doesn't have a detrimental effect, and it doesn't mean that the questioning should be tolerated. The Liberal Party has historically strong links with the corporate sector, and I think it is time that it began to examine some of the efforts made within that sector to tackle cultures that impede the progress of women. Having worked for a number of major corporates, I'm not about to pretend that they have fixed all of this or that they represent some kind of gender utopia. They certainly don't. But I do give them credit for at least acknowledging the impact of indirect and direct discrimination, having a discussion about it to raise awareness of the issue and introducing policies and practices aimed at eliminating it. And I see no reason why a political party shouldn't do the same. Another question, possibly to preempt from the end of this, is why doesn't the Liberal Party just introduce a quota system? Because that seems to have worked quite well elsewhere. Well, the first reason is that they've spent nearly 20 years opposing it, and I don't think they're going to change their minds now. One exception to this is former Victorian Senator Judith Troth, who back in 2010 argued that there should be a quota. She said this hadn't always been her view, but it had developed from years of frustration at watching small and incremental change in the number of Liberal women in the federal parliament. And she wrote, "The custom defence against quotas is the what about merit argument, as if to be for quotas means you must be against merit. Like the charge of tokenism, it eventually fails the test of reason after sitting in a parliamentary party room for nearly 20 years without seeing a progressive increase in the cohort of women members. As if those handful of women members who were there were the only women of merit who put themselves forward for pre-selection." And the Senator also noted that since 1944, the Victorian Liberal Party has reserved some 50% of its positions within the organisation for women as delegates and as senior office bearers, and this exists in other states too, to lesser and varying degrees. So Senator Troth called for the introduction of a quota system for the Victorian division, and she suggested that it start with a minimum of 40% of its seats for the election that was due last time, and recommended that this be increased to 45% within a five-year period, and that women must comprise 50% of people who went through candidate training. Her suggestions were not accepted. They were, you know, roundly condemned, and unfortunately the issue was put to one side once more. More recently, there's been a very, very low-key suggestion that, like the major corporates, the Liberal Party should discuss having targets for women, and I'll be interested to see if these suggestions translate into action of any kind. In 2 years' time, I'm sure we will see the women of the ALP celebrating the 20th anniversary of the introduction of their quota, and they will be calculating the very large number of women who've gone into Parliament as a result. And, you know, it's a 20-year process. I think it's worth considering where they started from. When they began that journey, to use the clichéd term, back in the 1980s, there were very few Labor women in the Parliament. And those who were there could see a lot of women on the other side of the chamber. And the electoral cycle posed its own challenges as well. And I suspect that this was a task that must have at some time seemed almost impossible. And yet it was brought out into the open, it was debated, and it was dealt with. And even if you don't agree with how they set out to fix the problem, the ALP at least admitted that its old approach wasn't working. They needed to change, and they found a way to get more women into Parliament. And the Liberal Party has a history of analysing its own shortcomings in an organisational sense and changing. It has done that historically a number of times. And I guess the most significant of these was the formation of the party from the remnants of the UAP, as well as with other organisations, including the AWNL, which I've talked about so much today. And I think that it's time for the Liberals to take a lesson from the past. They need to acknowledge the problem, stop relying on a blind faith in merit to somehow provide an increase in numbers of female MPs to solve this problem. I think the past provides a template of sorts. Acknowledge the problem, have the debate, get the leaders on side. But don't pretend that this isn't happening. Most of all, I think it's time to have an honest conversation about women, whether women are attempting pre-selection on an even playing field in a merit-based system, or whether there are some other cultural impediments that need to change. And I suspect that if this conversation is not had, then the Liberal Party is going to continue to see a trend of declining numbers of women relative to the ALP in parliaments around the country. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Margaret, for a very interesting lecture. We have some time for some questions. There are microphones at both sides of the room there. Margaret, I'll start off with a question, if I might. What led you into the research of this? It's a fascinating topic. Was there a particular event that sparked your interest in this area?
There was this is really nerdy, but there was a reference in one of the biographies of Alfred Deakin that referred to the AWNL, and it was an extract from his diary in which he discussed how much he hated them and how badly they were treating him. And it struck me that he wouldn't be saying that if they didn't matter. And I wanted to find out the story behind the quote. So I spent some time at the National Library and looked at the papers and started to delve into some of the other primary sources that sort of deal with this time. So that was the start of it.
Fantastic.
Mm. Thanks, Margaret. I was just thinking about the rather negative portrayal of our current serving Prime Minister by some sections of the media. Mm. And I was just wondering if you've got any general comments to make about the role that the media might play in encouraging or more likely discouraging women, and particularly young women, from entering politics and seeking high office.
Okay. I think this is a really complex issue. There are no easy answers to that issue. I think in general terms it's true that politicians of both genders are at times treated very, very badly and in a way that I think is unreasonable by the media and by people who use the media. And by that I'm thinking of blogs in particular can come out with some really, really unpleasant, just totally unacceptable stuff. I think that there are times when Julia Gillard has been treated in a totally unreasonable way that's gender specific. But I'm also conscious that her predecessors have at times had, you know, their appearances ridiculed and have been treated with derision as well. There's quite a lot of studies that have looked into this, and they do show that women tend to have things like their appearance commented on far more, and their families and so on and so forth. Does it put people off? I suspect it probably does. And I think one of the ways that it does, I think, is when people's very personal decisions are questioned, or when aspects of their family and their personal lives, parts of their lives that are undoubtedly personal, they're not front and centre, are put out there for public debate. I think there are certainly probably people out there who look at that and say, that's not really something I want to be part of.
Thank you.
Yes, over here.
Thank you, Margaret. I was wondering if you could comment on whether women voters would back a woman representative to replace Tony Abbott at the next election?
It's an interesting one. Sorry, you mean women MPs, whether they would...
Voters.
Whether they would support... Well, I mean, you know, if things proceed as they are now, I think it's very likely, you know, there will be a woman opposing Tony Abbott for that election. The big issue there is incumbency. I mean, that's the thing you need to strip out of any study that looks at whether gender makes a difference. Most of the studies, and there was one that came out very, very recently from Canada that looked at this issue again, show that gender's generally neutral. If anything, in some elections and in some electorates, having a woman is a positive. And that seems to be something that some of the states have played on a bit in years gone by.
Yes, over there.
I just wanted to ask a question that sort of followed on from the one about the media. I mean, I wonder to what extent does having a female Prime Minister and a female Attorney General at the moment actually encourage women to see that there is a role for them in politics? Mm. And why, if, in a sense, I get the impression that Dame Margaret Guilfoyle might have been a high watermark of some sort in Liberal women's participation, why didn't that sort of role model encourage more Liberal women to go into politics?
Okay, well, to address the second part of your question first, Beryl Beaurepaire said to me when I was researching Margaret Guilfoyle, and she was very much a contemporary of hers, she said, "I think the problem with Margaret was she set the standards so high that people thought they had to be as good as her." And she was someone who, on any measure, was a standout. I mean, she was one of the stayers of the Fraser ministry, one of the very few who was there at the start and there at the end. She was trusted by the Prime Minister, who, you know, many of her colleagues found notoriously difficult to work with. She was respected. She had a following in the community. She did some really significant reforms, and she pioneered women's participation in economic portfolios, which was a very new thing. So she was a standout, leaving aside her gender. You know, if she'd been Fred Guilfoyle, you know, she probably wouldn't have been in the Senate. She would have been in the House of Reps. But anyway, so that was Beryl Beaurepaire's assessment of that, you know, she had set a standard that was impossibly high. And I think that's quite perceptive in a way. I think there might have been something in that. I think at the time there was no general push as well that accompanied that, that Margaret Guilfoyle was sort of seen as special and a bit of a one-off in some ways. The issue of whether having women in, you know, senior ministerial roles encourages others, I think it does. I think it does. And I think the younger you are, the more powerful it is. I have three children. I have two daughters, and the eldest is nearly 10. And she thinks it's totally normal that the Prime Minister is female, the Governor General is female, and there are other women who are on television every night talking about their senior ministerial portfolios. So if you grow up with that as normal rather than as something to strive for, I think it can't help but make a change.
Yes, on this side.
Thank you for a very interesting talk. Thoroughly enjoyed it. I always find it fascinating when white men look at a process that always selects white men and think it has merit. And I do recollect back in the, I think it was under the Keating government, but it was a front bench spokesman from the Liberal Party who I heard on AM one day commenting how interesting it was that with exactly the same selection criteria for SES, the Department of Social Security managed to have 50% of women and the Departments of Finance and Treasury had almost none. So it does seem to me that what you have here is very clearly a process that is not a merit-based process. But you also have a group of decision makers who simply fail to recognise this fact. How can you get them to see the reality?
Well, thank you for that very easy question. and I do agree with your comment about white men. Not that I want to offend all the white men here, but you are right. well, the way Susan Ryan did this, and she discusses this in her autobiography, is she got the numbers. She got some research done that showed the advantages that would flow to the Labor Party if they pre-selected more women. And that was based very much on trying to capture that women's vote from the Liberal Party. So I think the term that she used from memory in her autobiography is numbers are like gold. That was the only way I could get their attention. It wasn't by arguing that it was about merit or justice or it was fair or that it, you know, there were a range of other arguments you could make. It was about showing this is how it will affect elections. So I suspect that is partly key to it. you need real research to show how these things are going to happen. I suspect the other thing too is capturing the extent of the problem, because I think when you have, you know, the sort of questioning that I've talked about in pre-selections, that rarely becomes public. It's not a very visible problem, and I think there's an awareness that it happens, but I think most people would be surprised at the extent to which it happens. So I think that would be quite a powerful tool in possibly starting to shift some views.
Yes, on this side.
Thanks. And just on that, also I found it very interesting. Thank you very much for the talk. But can I ask about what institutional structures there are in the Liberal Party? I understand, for example, that there's a focus on mentoring and training. But what structures are there that could assist that, that might be similar to, for example, Emily's List? Not the same, but something that will actually facilitate the training, the mentoring, the recruitment of women candidates.
Okay. I can't speak authoritatively on this, but I do know there are a range of training programs for all sorts of, you know, people, young people, potential candidates and women. And the women's ones do ebb and flow a little bit. They're usually around, but not always. I guess, you know, I used to think that was probably a good idea, but I've come to the view that it's not the issue. It's not about skilling up the women or telling them what they need to wear or, you know, who they need to speak to or how to build a CV that looks good or how to write their pre-selection speech so that it lasts the right amount of time. It's actually about the process they're going through. And I think that when you rely heavily on training and mentoring, it implies in some ways that the women need help. Now, I think all candidates need help. I don't know that women need particular help. I think they need a fair hearing. So that's a structural change that I would like to see in how this is dealt with.
Yes, over there.
My question's in a little bit of a similar vein, I think. Particularly if the Labor Party uses student politics and activism generally and the junior trade union movement as something of a training ground, can you make some comparative comments about what the Liberal Party has in terms of early processes and structures for the young emerging talent at that university level?
Well, there is some similarity in student politics. There are, you know, the Liberal students, there are young Liberals as well, and there's a fair crossover between the two. And there are a range of people who've come out of that. And, in fact, if you look at Victoria, with the state of Victoria, that is with Sophie Mirabella and Kelly O'Dwyer, I mean, they're both veterans of student politics. So there is that funnel. But the missing part, I think, in equivalence is the trade union movement. I don't believe that the Liberal Party has an equivalent to that. At all. You know, and it's interesting looking at historically, many of the unions weren't exactly helpful to the cause of women, but that has over time, through again some quite deliberate strategies and effort, has changed and it's reversed and has become, I think, quite a powerful advocate in many instances for women. So, I think the Liberal Party does have, you know, less on its side of the ledger in that regard. It's just how it is.
Lucky last question on the right.
Hello, Margaret. Good to hear you talk about Liberal women again. I'm Gail Radford. We met in Northern Victoria several years ago. You're the one with the absolute grasp of the history. Thank you for that. I'm also a member of the Women's Electoral Lobby, and we like to get in there and get things done. It seems to me now is a very good time to strike and really get this before the party for the next federal election. But I guess my first question is, have they finished selection for your candidates for the next federal election? Because if not, I mean, now is the time to get, you know, for a group of women to get in there. Is there anything going on, do you know?
They vary from state to state in terms of the timetables. In Victoria, most of the marginal seats have just been completed. And there's... In Victoria, there's, on the basis of polling, there's likely there'll be more seats, more marginal Labor-held seats in play than have been previously. Mm-hmm. One woman candidate has been selected for the most marginal seat, which is Corangamite. Sarah Henderson is going to contest that seat. And, you know, if you're going to put money on it, she'll probably do well and win the seat there. But in the rest of the seats, if you look at seats like, you know, Deakin, Chisholm and so on, men have been pre-selected. Slow progress. As to the other states, I think their programs might be slightly later. They certainly don't all align. They're not done at the same time. So I can't give any sense of what's happening in other states, but I'm not aware that there's a sudden, you know, groundswell in women for the next federal election. But I hope I'm wrong.
It's a shame if they don't, because, I mean, this is a big opportunity, obviously, as the polls are showing. This is your big opportunity to get the women back in again. Okay, thanks, Margaret.
No problem.
Well, thank you all very much for attending. We look forward to seeing you again soon, and please join me in thanking Margaret for her lecture.